Hello, my friends. Today we are talking to Alexi, the CTO and co-founder of Datadog, and we discuss the Datadog origin story, building a strong relationship with the open source community, and the benefits of bringing in talent that is driven and excited by the day-to-day. Also, our friends at Datadog have been nice enough to offer a free t-shirt to listeners of our podcast, so all you have to do is head over to datadoghq.com/modern CTO and check them out.
Here we go.
This is the Modern CTO Podcast.
Hello.
Hey. Hey, Joe.
Hey, buddy. How are you doing, man?
Good. How are you?
We're here. We're doing it. Well. Yeah. Are you excited?
Yeah. So happy new year, by the way, I guess to both of you.
Happy New Year. Yeah. Where are you celebrating? Where are you at right now?
I'm in New York. So this is, I'm just in the office. You can see, I don't know what you can see behind me.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
New York City. What part of New York?
New York Times Square.
Ah, all right. Yeah. There you go. Is it pretty exciting?
Well, you know, it depends. It's an acquired taste. I'll say that.
How was the big New Year's like event?
I don't know. I never go there because it gets pretty rowdy. It's actually, we're close enough to Times Square that it's really hard to get to the office that day. So most people just don't even bother. It gets, you know, you have people standing in line for hours, like literally for the entire day in Times Square waiting for the ball to drop. So that's the kind of thing you do once and then you kind of never do it again.
I have no desire. There's not a bone in my body that desires to stand in a crowd all day to watch the ball drop.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Many years ago, I tried to do it and then I got discouraged and I said, it's not worth it.
Yeah. There's not a huge reward or payoff because you can sit there on your couch and you can just watch it and you can not only do that, but you get the music, you get the multiple people, you get different cities. It's like, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful experience.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Awesome. So like, I want to take it back to the beginning, right? To like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in France, in a medium sized city, relatively far from Paris, you know, at least scaled to the country. And it's a sort of, it's still a university town. My parents were teaching at a university, and it was kind of a quiet life. You know, there's not much compared to New York, not much, you know, it's a very different level of excitement or of energy.
And so you grew up there, and then at the age of 10, you designed Datadog, or is there like stuff in the middle?
Yeah, no, it will be a very different, you know, very long road before we get to Datadog. So, I did get exposed to computers reasonably early on. I think I remember my parents bought a ZX Spectrum from Sinclair Computers. I think a British manufacturer in the 80s. So that's the first computer I got really to use at home. It had a tape player, a cassette player. That's how you load the, you know, whatever software. And at that age, it was mostly games I was interested in, as you can imagine. But it was an early, contact with computers. Then I picked up more, you know, got an upgrade to, I think it was an Atari maybe. And started to dabble a little bit in coding, but I'd say it remained mostly definitely a hobby thing and not really, I didn't go really deep back then, throughout my youth. I was mostly, you know, in school, studying and so, you know, I'll fast forward a little bit, you know, go to college. When I graduated college, I got a chance to intern in the U.S. in New York, New York State, just upstate from New York City, for IBM, one of their R&D center. And I was really excited because it's I always had the desire to live and, you know, work, but live abroad for some period of time. So this is where I'd say, you know, IBM is where I really started my, you know, my career, but really to use computers professionally. Before it was, you know, a lot of meddling around. When in college, I was, you know, this is also the days when Linux was coming, sort of coming out on the scene. So I had a pile of floppy disks to install Slackware. So again, that kind of dates when I went to college. And so I spent half of my time installing that, and then the other half of time trying to make something useful out of it, which was, not always brilliant results. The one thing that came out, which will link me to Datadog much later, is when in college, I had a sort of brand new Linux installation set up, and I was trying to learn the tools and trying to figure out what was running on the network. So I was nmapping around like crazy, and at some point, one day, you know, after a day of exploring the network, I come back, you know, I go to class and I come back and there's no network. The port is dead. It's like, oh, this was fairly cranky, all the hardware. So I said, oh, maybe just the card died. I'm just going to go talk to the folks who run the network, and they'll just give me a new card, and they'll be that. I'll resume my exploring activities. But it turns out, actually, no, the port was dead because I was disconnecting from the network, because somebody had figured out that I was, you know, looking around a little bit too much curiosity, and they decided to turn me off. One of the people who is part of that decision is actually the CEO of Datadog. So I met him, unbeknownst to both of us. We met, you know, I don't know, 22, 23 years ago. Me hacking, if you will, and he policing my behavior. But then that was that, you know, that's the, if you will, the genesis of Datadog 25 years ago. And then we met again by chance in New York, actually. It was somewhat random. He interned also in the same program, though a couple of years later. And so we started to work together. So we had met unofficially a few years before doing that sort of hacking incident, and then we started to work together, and we've been working, he and I, almost continuously ever since. Not quite true. There were a few gaps, but fundamentally, somebody I've known for a long time. So during that long collaboration, at some point emerged the idea of Datadog, and that was, I'd say, 2009, so 10 odd years ago. That's when really Datadog became an idea. Before it became a thing in a company, it started as an idea.
So were you guys like hanging out after work hours, like conceptualizing? Yeah.
Pretty much. In 2009, AWS had already come out with EC2, S3, and a couple of other services, but the level of sophistication and the level of power that they would provide was just not quite good enough for what was then the traditional, you know, enterprise workload. But it had that promise of being able to think about compute in a fairly different way. And I'll give you a bit more context. Back then, so about 10 years ago, so both he and I were working together in a SaaS company in education. And this was a thing for both of us, really interesting and formative years. It was our first real SaaS experience, and it was early 2000, you know, 2001 through basically the first decade. And it sort of taught us some of the lessons on how to run a SaaS service. And so one of the lessons was, well, you need compute power. Back then we had data centers and, you know, collocations, and it took time to provision that compute power, and that I think got us interested in the cloud and its potential. The second thing it taught us is And this was fairly new. SAS was teaching us that in order to run the service properly, you need all the stars to be aligned. You need the code to run. You know, you need the code to be delivered. You need the code to run properly. You need people to react to failures and errors. And it ends up being much more of a team sport than what software engineering had been before, which was, you know, you build, and we did that prior also in the prior years, is you build some software, you put it in a CD, you ship the CD, you're done, and you never really see it again. And then you just kind of move on to the next thing. I think SAS broke that completely, and it had some good and some bad, you know, bad effects. The good effect is, I think it made it so that there's no more like, oh, this is maintenance work, because maintenance work and new feature work is one and the same. And so that's been positive. The difficult part about SaaS is like you have to be running 24/7, and that's something it's difficult for, you know, an organization cannot improvise itself as a SaaS, as a SaaS, I guess, organization overnight. It just takes time. Now, in the context of the founding story of Datadog, where with SaaS, you know, with SaaS requiring SaaS being a team sport, what we saw is that the team didn't exist per se. You had dev and ops, and there were two different groups, and they didn't collaborate together, and that was an issue, because the quality of service does suffer if both groups don't work hand in hand. And so that what it gave us as an insight is we need both groups of people who have maybe different day-to-day lives, but nonetheless congregate to make the service successful. We need to give them a sort of a common reality. We need to give them the same data so that they can look at and understand the health of the service, the health of a particular component, the health of a particular system, you know, particular, I don't know, anything from the ground up, they have to be able to look at and understand whether that's working properly or not. Because ultimately, not everything has to work properly for the SaaS, for the service to be delivered properly, but you need kind of the baseline of things to operate as designed to be able to move forward. So, for us to give analytics visualizations, like for people to be able to see things, that was particularly important, I think. We didn't quite know at the time. And so when we went to, you know, when we discussed with our very first users and potential users, I think we thought, oh, they already got that visualization stuff. It's not going to be interesting to them. We're just going to move straight to the, you know, deep and the statistical or machine learning processing, and that's going to be what's going to be, you know, what's going to resonate with them. But actually, at least back in the late, you know, in 2009, 2010, there was still the need for people to be able to see the data about their service, about their infrastructure, about their application. In a number of cases, it was that too were siloed. The teams were siloed. The tools were siloed. So you couldn't get a complete picture. Without the complete picture, it made, you know, thinking about the problem globally very difficult. And thus, the quality of service ultimately suffered for, if you didn't have a unified view, just that you can see things, you couldn't think about them. And that's I guess, you know, that's how we are as human beings. Like, it helps tremendously to be able to visualize something, and it you know, helps your mental model, if you will.
Yeah, we're hugely vision oriented. I want to get this part of the conversation, because I was really curious about it. Because you guys, you know, you provide so many analytics, you obviously are involved with the open source community to some degree, but like, what is your relationship like with the open source communities?
So it's been one where that's largely driven, you know, by, I think, some level of pragmatism and some level of, you know, let's say, goodwill. The pragmatism is the decision we made as a SaaS provider is to say, well, look, we're going to instrument your application and your infrastructure fairly deeply. We'll need to run some of your code, you know, inside your, you know, perimeter, not real perimeter, but, you know, on your stuff. And there's no, it's a lot easier for us to say, look, all the stuff you're going to run from us will be open source. From a security and safety and trust perspective, it's particularly important. Now, that doesn't mean that all customers will necessarily look at every single line of code we give them, but nonetheless, they can always do so. And so that's the pragmatism in us saying it makes sense. And then there's the recognition that we run our backend systems are, you know, largely based on open source components. You know, we run Linux, so we run a number of, you know, SQL databases, NoSQL databases. We're in our own code as well, but it's really a mix. And so, you know, we're trying to be mindful of that and, you know, and support things wherever it makes sense, whenever we can. We're fairly involved in various, you know, CNCF projects or open telemetry. I mean, there's a number of collective efforts we want to be involved in, not necessarily for the sake of, because we think it's cool. I think because we think it's useful, and partially because we think it's, you know, we need to give back in a way that makes sense.
There is like, I love the companies that contribute with purpose to open source, right? Because it's so useful. And I really like that you guys are out there doing that. But like, you're not just doing it just because it's cool to contribute. You're doing it with like a purpose, like in a purposeful way.
Yes, I think for the effort to be sustainable, it has to be that way. Otherwise, you know, the risk is, you know, I don't know, the mood changes, or and then that support goes away. So I think it's never as effective as when it is purposeful and it's useful both to the company as well as to its customers and hopefully to the ecosystem at large.
So what are your like objectives? Like, it's the new year, right? What's going on? Like, what are you pumped about in 2020?
So 2020, it's the first, you know, full year of Datadog as a public company, and so that is we went public last September, and that's pretty exciting. It's challenging. We'll see. You know, it's hard to say what will pan out. Generally speaking, I think what we've always believed and we've communicated and shared that with everybody in the company is while it's an interesting validation, you know, external validation, going public and so on, the day to day doesn't really change. The focus was back then on the customers. He is still on the customer, will be on the customer, because that ultimately is hugely important. What makes a company? It's, you know, customers, employees. And then at some point, yes, you need capital, but that's I think comes as a distant third. So there's a level of excitement and you know, I'm looking forward to 2020, but also I know it'll have its share of challenges and there'll be the good days, the hard days. As the French expression goes, you know, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. So the more it changes, the more it's the same. I think that's particularly true. I'm excited about seeing, you know, we've grown the team. It's been almost 10 years and it's been always amazing to see people evolve with the company. And much like, I think the company we worked for before Datadog was, I think to both my co-founder and I, the formative years, I think that's my dearest hope is for a number of people, Datadog is their formative years. And that's been true, I think, and at least for some people, and that's been a delight to watch.
That's exciting that you guys went public back in September. I'm going to go buy some Datadog stock.
I cannot say anything for or against that. So you'll have to make your own decision there.
That's right. But it's cool because you got the stock symbol DDoG. I like looked it up. I was like, oh, this is awesome. Congratulations. I was just talking with DraftKings, who's out in New York too, and they said that they just announced like last week that they're IPOing somehow.
Yeah,
I think through like an acquisition strategy. I'm not 100% sure, but I was talking with them and it was public news as of like last week. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Do you know those guys over there at DraftKings?
They happen to be some of our customers.
Cool.
We have a number of customers in New York in particular. So we've had them as customers for quite some time.
Are you proud that like you've become like the product that you helped build and the company helped build has become like a standard? Like everybody knows Datadog. They like use Datadog. You could get, I mean, it's just like, it's a really good product. It's a well-designed UI. It's a well-designed user experience. Like I was a fan of it when Chloe told me and she's like, hey, we could have Datadog on the show. I was like, that is very exciting for me. So my background is engineering. And so congratulations on building something amazing.
Well, thank you. I'll say, you know, the interesting thing about this whole journey is when people ask, hey, how's it, you know, essentially a variation of the question, either it's building the product from the ground up or becoming a larger company. So how does it feel like, as you know, the interesting thing is, to me, it feels very much like when you're between, you know, let's say 6 years old and 12. And I, you know, I at least I, that's how it felt to me, is from within. You know, it's of course there are changes, but they're slow and gradual, and you're not waking up, you know, when you're 10, you know, one day it's like, wow, I'm so different from who I was the day before. I mean, maybe some people do, but at least I didn't. But then in the eyes of your parents, of course, you know, from 6 to 12, it's a massive transformation. And so that's always made it difficult for me to answer that question. It's like, how does it feel? Well, it feels like, you know, just come in day after day, solve the problem of the day, and move on and show up the next day. That's really how it feels. And then once in a while, yes, you sort of look back and you look at the path, you know, the path traveled, and, you know, I think you can give yourself a half a second of, oh, okay, cool. And that's, you know, it's like you're hiking and then you're stopping at a viewpoint, you're taking stock. It's like, wow, this is really, it's worth the trip. I think that's mostly that. But then you walk on. It's always difficult, for me to feel, you know, anything that of a milestone, if you will. It's much more, it's a growing thing. I see its imperfections, you know, if anything, more than what works. The condition of having worked on something on something fairly singular, you know, the kind of the same thing for so long, is you're sort of you get also so accustomed to it that you're not realizing necessarily. That said, I was at reInvent last month, and this is always very energizing because you have new customers. Existing customers, new customers, prospect that come by, and then you just, you know, you can sense the excitement and the energy, and that's very positive. And this is why we made the decision early on to send people who actually build the product to the trade show. And it's something that typically in normal companies or larger companies, that's, you know, this would be the marketing department that goes to trade shows because that fits more the description. For us, it's been no, you're going to meet customers, you're going to meet users, you're going to demo the product, which will maybe feel intimidating if you're not particularly, you know, let's say extroverted or not particularly driven by or excited by that. But actually, everybody, I think, warms up to it, and everybody kind of gets that energy, gets that excitement, and that builds up, and everybody comes, you know, I think comes out of reInvent really tired because it's a lot of work, but it's also really energized.
No, and I like that you do that too, because I've seen a lot of people be resistant to it because they're like, oh no, I'm a INTJ, whatever their acronym is, right? Like, I'm this, or they build up the reasons about why they wouldn't want to go do that or couldn't do that.
Yeah.
But it's like all the humans have the capacity inside. It's like, you know, no one's a runner until there's a tiger behind them, right? Yeah,
that's right.
Like, then you're a runner. But I think like people have that capacity. So if they tap into that, it's actually really valuable for them to have that relationship with the customer, to see it through their eyes, and then they'll come back with insights. And for you, when you do that, it keeps your product like right on the cutting edge, because you have these people who are influencing the decisions and the directions of the product, engaging directly with the customers.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And that puts a face also to you know, to who's using your product. And one of the many, many lessons we've learned, I think, in this journey is the customer. So, you know, you serve customers, you know, day in, day out. There'll be a number of successes. There'll be a number of failures. We will, you know, we'll trip once in a while, and that's, you know, that's what it is. I mean, there's no not something we're looking forward to, but nonetheless something that happens. And we've seen time and again initially customers maybe who were frustrated initially, but rather than treat that as, oh my god, there's an angry customer, what do we do, let's run away, I think we conversely try to run towards a situation like that, because we recognize that somebody who's frustrated and angry is somebody who cares. Now, it'd be better if they were happy, and this is our chance to make them happy in the end. But nonetheless, I think the death of any service is just having users who don't care. It's like they effectively put your stuff, you know, up on the shelf and never look at it again. That is death for SaaS. Happy customers are great, and, you know, don't get me wrong. First three customers are they're for us an opportunity to make things right, you know. And so that's been an important lesson for me, at least personally, throughout the years, is to recognize it's for us to rectify. And the reality is, I think, you know, in any normal, you know, relationship, if you're frustrated, someone helps you, even if the person, you know, you associated with person with the source of frustration, if the person is able to fix, you know, make the pain go away, alleviate the frustration, you're naturally will, you know, resume your sort of revert back to a much more positive interaction. And that's been something that that we've seen time and again, and that's important. So when we put engineers in front of customers, you know, through trade shows and sometimes through a number of customer meetings, sometimes the interaction can start a little bit tense, and that's happened. And it is, we always see it as this is our chance to make it right, and you know, this is the glass half full, I think, view of customer service is if we messed up at one point, then we can fix and correct.
And you need a lot of great people to do that, right? Like, you have to have great people at your core. What's your strategy for developing or, you know, recruiting new talent?
It's that's a great question. And this is, I think, ultimately one of the key elements of generally fast growing companies. So if you think about fast growing companies that have a sort of viable business, what they've solved already is building something that people, that customers want. And so when that's solved, what remains is, you know, how do you grow? How do you keep growing? How do you control your growth? How do you bring great people in so that you can continue to execute at the same level? And that's a really difficult question. So I don't really have a silver bullet there. We try to do a couple of things. One is, around sourcing, we try to be fairly broad. We We have offices in a number of places around the world. So we're just trying to tap the, you know, the global talent as opposed to being just focused on one particular area. The other thing is, throughout the hiring process, we try to keep it as repeatable as possible, as structured and repeatable as possible, so that everybody effectively for the same job goes through the same process with the same questions, more or less. There's always going to be variability between, you know, the interviewer, the interviewee, and so on. So that's life. There's nothing we can do about it. But at least we try to eliminate, you know, sort of improvisation of interview questions and stuff like that, because that makes the ultimate decision really difficult to make. If everything is variable, then, you know, what signal can you drive? We also try to give people a sense of what it is they'll be doing. And ideally, they can give us a sense of what they can achieve as well. And the analogy that I have is, if you want to open a restaurant, you know, let's say you're providing capital and you found a place and so on, and you have an idea of a theme. At some point, you need people to cook, right? And so you're going to talk to people, you're going to, you know, source and so on. But ultimately, you'll make part of your decision based on, well, just please cook a meal for me. And then that'll tell me if that, you know, matches the idea that I have for that restaurant. And so for us, it's a little bit the same. It's like, can we give you, maybe in a contrived fashion, something for you to do that mirrors what it is that you'll be doing in your job? Not as, of course, not in full depth, not in full breadth, but just, you know, so if you're tasked with, if most of your job, you're going to be writing code and working with others, then can we think of a sort of contrived example where, well, can you give us some code? You know, can you write some code for us in the context of this? Or if you've already written extensively, you know, code extensively, it's available on GitHub, then we'll take that. So we're not going to, you know, force you through the contrived exercise. But the idea is that we want to separate how in the hiring process, ways where we get signal about what you can do and ways where we get signal about who you are, how you behave in a, you know, sort of in a group. And so these are fairly distinct questions we're trying to answer about new candidates. And then we, you know, we go through the hiring process, we make a decision, you know, we offer a job, job's accepted. Then we continue to work for at least 90 days to figure out, you know, constant check-ins, like, how is it going? Is this what you expected as a new hire? Is what you expected to do? Is this, and conversely, is, you know, is Datadog the right place for you? So we sort of each, you know, both parties sort of assess continuously. And after 3 months, usually you sort of kind of know, you know, where you are. And in the vast majority of cases, people are just happy and continue to refer their friends and so on. So that's particularly important. But you're right. It is attracting and retaining great talent is essential. It's as important as, you know, serving customers, building great product.
So what are some of the behaviors that you value? What are some of the things that you value?
That's always it's a deceptively simple but very profound question, in the sense that and I think you framed it exactly right. We don't have what we call values, or, you know, a number of companies have that, and this is born out of the belief that of all companies that have values, a number of them will act, you know, poorly. And they have great sounding values, but they will not live up to their values. So at some point, we said, you know what, rather than saying, well, we'll be this and that and this and that, how about we try to think about how we behave? And this is how we work together, how we work as individuals, how we solve problems. And so that's a little bit more actionable for people also. So some of the things some of the behaviors we value highly is the absence of BS in normal interactions. And so I think we like when people say, you know, things directly and without embellishment, use, you know, simple words to convey simple ideas. That's important. We like when people, when they don't know, they say, I don't know. I think the next thing is they could say, but I can find out. And here's how I plan to find out. But it's not a, it's okay to not know. I mean, nothing, right? Nobody knows everything. That's totally fine. I think, so honesty, just having people having honest, you know, just direct conversations, I think is easier. We like people to be pragmatic. And so pragmatism, in the context, for instance, the context of software, means sort of starting from the problem and going to the solution, not starting from the solution, going to the problem. And so ways, sort of non-pragmatic behaviors can be, let's say, a bit more ideological. Somebody thinks that, you know, this piece of technology is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and you know, they're totally entitled to their opinion. That's fine. But that doesn't mean that this is the basis for a decision to use, you know, database X or framework Y or, you know, ID, you know, VI versus Emacs, or things like that. This is, you know, I think we want to tie it back to what is the problem we're trying to solve. And ultimately is, what is the customer? How does solving this problem helps the customer? How does it help the customer? That is the thing that we try to never lose track of, right? So to not get fall in love with the particular technical problem we're trying to solve, or how are we going to solve it? Particularly if it's material to the customer, it may be a worthwhile problem in its own right, but it just not the right context for us to solve that problem. So, you know, generally speaking, I think there's a lot of, you know, choice for people, industry, you know, of employers. So we want people who want to be here, you know, who are sort of, I'd say, driven, generally speaking, driven, not passionate, like, because I think it's a different thing, but driven by, you know, excited by the day to day. That's the important thing. I'll take passionate people as well, but I think it's, I've always felt uncomfortable when it sounds like it has to be your passion for you to be able to succeed in this company. What we do is monitoring and analytics for software, you know, software stacks. I doubt that there's that many people in the world who wake up in the morning and say, this is what I've been waiting my entire life to do. And that's fine. That doesn't have to be. For me, in my prior life, when I was working in education, SaaS for education, like you know, this was not my calling to work in education world. I supported the, you know, the cause and so on, but I was not passionate about it. There were passionate people about it, but I was not one of them. But I think I still, what I liked about the environment back then, it let me still grow and develop. And that's exactly what we want to be for people here as well. You don't, we ask that you be committed and driven to do what you have to do, but that has to be a passion. You don't have to, you know, wake up Sunday morning and say, oh, I can't wait to, you know, write code on what it is I'm working at work. That doesn't have to be. You're perfectly fine. It's perfectly okay to have different passions, you know, in life. That's fine.
Yeah, and they change and evolve as humans do, right?
That's right.
Like your new parent, right? All of a sudden, you've got some family passion in you, right?
Yeah. And I can speak of experience there. So,
oh, yes. Yeah. How many kids do you have?
I have two kids, two little girls. They're still, you know, 2 and 4. So, it's another amazing adventure, but probably not so relevant for this podcast.
No, it's perfectly relevant. People love it. I think people in technology have children. I hope they do. I have two under two. So I've got a 2.5-year-old girl, and then I've got a 10-month-old baby boy.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a lot of work.
Yes, it is a lot of work. It is it's an incredible amount of work. And the interesting thing is, for me, it was it had an effect that I did not anticipate before they were born. Is in the early years of the company, one of the things that I find difficult about about startups is they consume all your mental space. They don't necessarily consume all your time, but they consume all your mental space. That's all you really think about. And this is difficult for people around you. It's hard for them to relate, and you sort of don't really, it takes extra effort to kind of include people in and say, well, this is what I'm going through. This is why I'm, you know, kind of, if I sit at the dinner table and I'm sort of gazing in the, you know, in space, it's because maybe there's a problem I'm thinking through. When the kids arrived, that sort of went out of the window really quickly because they obviously, you know, demand and require rightly so much attention that it creates, for me at least, it created a sense of balance that was maybe not there before. And so that was unexpected, but I think it was, it's great. I cannot imagine, you know, going through, growing the company with other kids. I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, I was listening to one of the leadership authors, I think John Maxwell, and it was just in like a private interview deal. It wasn't like in one of his Audible books or anything, but he was talking about specifically like his grandkids or his nephews or something. He said, the rule of thumb I have is when they come up and they interrupt me and I'm working, that I will pay attention to them every time that they interrupt me, because what he found out through like measuring it is that they only ever have like a 2-minute attention span. Yes. So like when they come up to you, and like I've been good about developing this habit of, you know, when the two and a half year old comes up to me, Ario, and she's like, daddy, I'm like, all right, let's go. What do you want? Like, let's do it. Like, let's go fairy tale, crush a mountain, monster truck jam, chase you chase me, whatever you want. Cause inevitably it lasts 2 minutes. And it's the equivalent of like for me going out and taking a walk, and it clears my mind, helps me solve the problem. Yep. So I made like a core decision after hearing that like I will adopt that like fundamentally as part of who I am, because yep. I don't want in her memory for me to be the one that she's always like pulling on my shirt and me ignoring her.
Yeah.
Because it's so easy to do. It's like, it's my default, because I'm in somewhere else in my head.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's very wise.
Dude, we're getting some good stuff. See, we go down this kid path. teaches you a lot about AI too. I'm like, give these computers a break. These little creatures, man, they're processing with billions of neurons for hundreds of waking hours before they even realize their feet exist.
Yeah. That in itself is it's an amazing process. It's funny. How you never remember, you know, you obviously don't remember those important years, but that's when you watch the kids, grow up and go through that. It's like, wow, it's awesome. It's like, it's completely mind boggling, like development of language, you know, just moving around, talking, forming, you know, having conversations, the world they see. And oftentimes I've found, they see things like we don't, as adults, we don't really see things anymore. It's all, for a number of reasons, but it's all filtered. But I remember when I walk around the neighborhood with my kids, it's like, there's this. It's like, wait, what, where? You know, I don't know, they see a bird somewhere. And yes, there's a bird, or they see something that's interesting. But I've sort of edited out, because it's half of it is, you know, me thinking about some other problem or, you know, walking around and it's kind of reading the signs subconsciously and ignoring half of it. But they see everything, and that's amazing.
It's like with the Christmas lights, we took them around the neighborhood to see, and she just wanted to go run up on the lawns. And I'm like, oh, you have to understand that there's this invisible barrier. Yeah. You can't go up into these people's property and start, you know, petting their inflatable unicorn, Christmas unicorn.
Yeah. They teach you profound stuff too.
Well, this is good. So as we start to wrap up here, let's say some people are listening and they're like, they value what you value, right? You mentioned honesty, a little bit of transparency, pragmatism, like being real, focusing on customer value. Let's say they're just like, they're driven. They like to wake up, craftsmanship. They like to do quality work. And that sounds like it aligns with Datadog quite a bit, right?
Yep.
So like, how do they go, where's your career page? Like, how do they go learn more about this?
So, you know, datadog.com/careers, I think that's where they start. There's a number of, you know, openings by function, by city, and so on, by country. And then they apply. So everything flows through the same, you know, system. So there's no fast track, no special way to get in and so on. I think you apply. When you're referred internally, even so, the referral will go through the exact same system. So the mechanics of the process will unfold, but fundamentally, I think we're trying to have to understand who a particular candidate is in terms of what they can do, what, you know, why they applied, how they think, how they function, and we try not to have like any brain teasers and stuff like that. It's all the questions we ask tend to be, you know, related to, you know, software engineering. Well, how you write software, for instance. It's fairly, and kind of want people to, you know, be themselves, you know, kind of think about, behave in a way that's going to be as close as possible as how they'll be once they join. And I know, you know, you go to an interview, you're nervous, it's normal. It's, you know, I've been through that. We try to make it as pleasant as possible. We try to make it as conversational as possible. We try to make it as, you know, as close as possible as it will be once you join and you have, let's say, a whiteboard discussion with a colleague and you're trying to solve a problem. So this is really the mode of operation we have. And I encourage, you know, people who think what we have to build and what we have to solve is valuable, you know, to apply.
Now, do you blog or you go around, you do some talking at conferences and stuff, right?
So I think as a group, we're fairly active on the conference, in conferences. We have an engineering blog.
What about you? You.
Oh, myself.
You. People like you.
Yeah. So truth be told, not as much as I used to, for one thing. And I think to some extent, the being a parent has played into that. I want others to be the voice of the company. I can be a voice of the company. That's fine, you know, but I don't like companies where, let's say founders are lionized and this is something, you know, this is so special about them and so on, because I don't think it's very healthy. I have interesting things to say. Sometimes I also have boring things to say. I don't, you know, I've always been a little bit, shy in a sense about, you know, putting things out there, because the time of, you know, your audience is limited. If I write something, it should be worth their while. And that's what I think that's always set me back a little bit and say, do I have really something that's both crisp and interesting to say? That's always been a little bit difficult. And I think what I found is in a conversation like this, it's a lot easier for me to, open up, if you will, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. Talk about what you enjoy and what you know. And if you talk about what you enjoy and what you know, then you win either way, regardless of how the outside world sees it. Like, you win because you got to wake up that day, share some of your experience, do something you enjoy doing. And I love the fact that you mentioned that you enjoy like empowering others and helping them rise up and develop their voice. I mean, that's like a super attractive, you know, feature, something that you like. It sounds like the way you look on your face when you said you like to help other people, you know, and their voices, like, that's a really cool, honorable thing. I like that.
Okay. Well, I'll make that one of my New Year's resolution is to, you know, to communicate more, definitely share more with the rest of the world. I'll I accept that.
So as we wrap up here, do you know Daily Motion?
Yes.
Do you know Guillaume?
I don't think so, actually.
Guillaume's been there for a while, and he goes between France and New York, NYC. Yeah. And he's just like, man, this guy, like, yeah, I would suggest that you listen to the podcast I have with him, because, man, he's got just this like unbelievable original like thoughts and content nonstop. I'm like, this guy was just unbelievable. And so because you have that background, France and then New York City, and then he does, I figure I'll connect the two of you, and you guys may, you know, do something awesome together, or at least have a good conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with pleasure.
Yeah. All right. So I'll connect you with Guillaume, and then we'll tell, put in the show notes for everyone about the Datadog career site, so they can go do their best work there with you and develop their voice there as well. So that's exciting. And then if you need anything at all, if I can ever help or bring you value in any way, maybe you just want to call up and talk about kids and technology, feel free, my friend. The door is always open.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Joel.
All right. Talk soon. Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.